So welcome everybody to Santi, this evening. I want to lead you in some guided metta meditation, and what I'll do for the remainder of the range retreat is focus mainly on doing this metta meditation for each of the guided meditations and try to take you in a little bit further or a little bit of a different direction each time. And we might do a few other things as well, but this is the main one I want to try to share with you. And I realize that not everybody will be doing metta meditation as the main meditation practice. It's not like in our tradition, in the Thai forest tradition, we don't kind of say, you know, you have to do my meditation practice and this is the only way and all of these kinds of sillinesses. But what we do is we try to share those things that we have the most experience of and that thing which we think we have the most to offer. So even if you might be doing other meditations, like breath meditation and so on, then you know you can still find a lot to reward you in doing some metta as well. I mean, for teaching, I will do some talks on breath meditation later on, but generally speaking, for teaching breath meditation, Ajahn Brahm's teachings are so superb and so clear and so inspiring and so accurate that there's not really much I have to add at all to that. So I would recommend strongly, if you're interested in breath meditation and you want to learn about that more deeply, then get hold of some of Ajahn Brahm's talks on the subject and basically do what he tells you to do, because that's not going to lead you astray. But my main meditation object has been metta for many years. And the reason being is that it's basically like a lolly. Metta meditation is very sweet. It's like a lolly that doesn't give you tooth decay. So if you're going to be spending a long time in your life meditating, then do something that you're going to enjoy. Even if you don't get enlightened, at least you can have a good time. It's better than not being enlightened and having a bad time. You've got something out of it. So metta will be a great support for every kind of meditation you might want to do. And will never lead you astray. It's one of the most safe and universal and beneficial of all meditation practices. Can't lead you to anything bad. So for this evening, to start with metta, we'll just do metta for the first stage, and that's metta for oneself. Okay, so I'm not going to talk too much about this practice. I'm going to leave it for a few weeks and just do a bit of guided meditation each week. And then given a few weeks down the track, I'll give some more detailed instructions on the meditation. But I'll do just a little bit each week, because as we know, it's all about doing it. It's not about, you know, lots of theory. And giving instructions about meditation is a little bit like giving instructions about how to ride a bicycle. You can put someone in a class, tell them how to ride a bicycle all day, but when they get on it, they're going to fall off. Doesn't matter how they could have been, they could have got a PhD in bicycle riding. Be the world's greatest expert on how to ride a bicycle, and then when they get on it, you're going to fall off. Because everyone does. And it's only by getting on and falling off a lot of times that you're going to learn how to ride it. Okay, so let's start with this first stage of metta meditation. To begin with, as with any meditation, we sit comfortably, yet alert. Posture composed, attention into the present moment. What are those sensations that are happening on the surface of your skin? Where are those muscles tense? Can you feel the beating of your heart? Feeling that deep space, it opens up as the mind settles, becoming one with the body. when the mind feels neutral, centered, we bring up the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Saying the words clearly, distinctly, firmly, making them an even and steady base for establishing one's mindfulness. May I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. concentrate on re-bringing your mind back to this thought of metta. May I be happy. May I be happy. Rely on this. Base yourself on this. Trust it. Trust these words of metta. Don't trust those other thoughts and ideas and emotions and everything. Trust just this. This is your path. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Commit yourself totally to this one thought of metta. May I be happy. May I be happy. Putting your whole heart into every word. Throwing yourself into every word. Again and again and again. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. now coming near the end of the meditation, let those words of metta go. Let the mind be silent. Focus mindfulness very carefully within that silence. Taste the quality of that. And take a couple of minutes to review over your meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. How did that go? How did I take up that meditation object? How did my mind change? What did I feel when that was happening? What is my mind like now? Finally, we can dedicate the merit of the practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings rejoice in the merit that we've made through our practice. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Ekayano ayam bhikkhave maggo sattanam visuddhiya soka parinirvanam samatikkamaya dukkha dommanassana attagamaya Yaya sa adhigamaya nibbanasa sacchikiriyaya yadidam chattaro satipatthana. So this evening I started a series of talks dealing with meditation, the practical aspects of the path of Buddhism. And in the first talk of the rains, I did talk about the Four Noble Truths, which is, in a sense, the alpha and omega of practice. It's like the teaching which we first hear that gives us faith in Buddhism. It's like the ABC, the kindergarten of Buddhism, and also is the ending of it. It's the ending of the path. It's that realization, which is like the breakthrough to the Dhamma. So the thing that makes a difference, the thing that makes those Four Noble Truths real, the things that can actualize those Four Noble Truths in our experience, is the path. Okay, so normally, of course, we just have two Noble Truths, suffering and the origin of suffering, which is not particularly noble. It's kind of two mediocre truths. And the thing that makes them noble is the path, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, and that ennobles the truths. So that's the difference between being unenlightened and being enlightened. As the Buddha said, one of the most important and profound suttas on the nature of our existence is in the Balapandita Sutta of the Sanyutta Nikaya. And the Buddha said, the unenlightened worldling, Asutta Vaputujano, is born into this world. And when they're born into this world, they have a body, they have a mind, they experience through the six senses pleasure and pain. And the enlightened Arahant, having been born in this world, even the enlightened one, will still experience pleasure and pain, suffering and happiness through these six senses in just the same way. So what's the difference between the Patujana, the unenlightened one, the fool, and the wise person, the sage? What's the difference between the fool and the sage? The fool gets born, experiences pleasure and pain. The sage gets born and experiences pleasure and pain. The difference between them is that the fool has not lived this holy life, has not fully developed this spiritual practice leading to the ending of suffering. So when this body ends, they go out and they get themselves another one. And when they get themselves another body, then they fall into birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. Whereas the wise person, the sage, the holy one, even though they've been born in this life and they experience pleasure and pain, their existential situation is exactly the same. But because they have lived the holy life for the rightly ending of suffering. Samma dukkha kayaya. So when this body ends, they don't go and get another one. They're finished. And so they don't tumble into that abyss of birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. They are freed from suffering. And this is the distinction, this is the difference between the fool and the sage. So, what is this holy life? What is this way of practice that the Buddha talked about so often? It was interesting, a little while ago, did a cursory survey of the Majjhima Nikaya, the suttas in there, and analyzed them all in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And I found out that actually there was a fairly small proportion of them dealing with the First Noble Truth, relatively few, only a small amount, dealing with the Second and Third Noble Truths, and the vast majority of them were dealing with the Fourth Noble Truth, is the path. So this, of course, is taught and phrased in endless variations, so many different ways that we can talk about the path. But perhaps the most important set of dhammas dealing with the path is what we call the Bodhipakkhiya dhammas, the translate them as the wings to awakening. 37 Bodhipakkhiya dhammas, and these are very important, and this is we form the framework of the teaching that I'll give for the rest of the range retreat, or most of the rest of the range retreat. These 37 Bodhipakkhiya dhammas, and you should all learn these, know them off by heart, inscribe them in the base of your consciousness so that they never leave them. These 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas are the four Satipatthanas, the four Iddhipadas, four bases of psychic power, the four right efforts, five spiritual faculties, the five spiritual powers, the seven enlightenment factors, and the Eightfold Noble Path. So if you add all of those up, then you get 37. And these 37 constitute the main teachings found in the section dealing with the path in the Samyutta Nikaya, a section of the Samyutta Nikaya called the Mahavagga. So please get a copy of that and have a look at it. There's also some good books that have been written on the subject. Get acquainted with these things and with these teachings in the original Pali as best you can, so that you know them instantly, easily, straightforwardly, right there, without having any doubts about them. So I'm going to start out with the first one of these, is the four Satipatthanas. And in particular the section on body contemplation. So I'll start out with that this week, and we'll see how far we go, and continue this out through the rest of the Rains Retreat. So, four Satipatthanas, body, feelings, mind, and dhammas. And the Buddha said, contemplate these things. Sounds straightforward enough. So you would fondly like to imagine. But not as straightforward as all that. The four Satipatthanas is in fact become one of the most controversial of all the Buddha's teachings. And there's something which everybody agrees are very important, and yet the actual interpretation of them varies quite dramatically. Nevertheless, let's have a look and see what we can have to say about them. Pali phrase I said at the beginning of the talk, Ekaya no ayam bhikkhave magga. Well, there starts the controversy, okay? Well, the first word of the Satipatthana Sutta, Ekayana, what does it mean? And if you wanted to find an answer to that, you really come to the wrong place, because I'm just going to add fuel to the fire, stir up the already muddied waters, and add another conflicting opinion to that already teeming ocean of controversy. So this word Ekayana means eka is one, ayana is going. It's very easy, one going. But the problem, of course, is in language. It's usually the simplest words which are hardest to figure out the exact meaning, because they're used in so many contexts and so many implications that it's hard to figure out exactly what it means. So some people say it means the one and only way. This is the one and only way. And that becomes like a very good kind of bludgeon that you can beat people over the head with. Ours is the one and only way. Bash. There you go. If you're not doing this way, you're not practicing the right way. Thump. This is the path. Everything else is the wrong path. Whack. It's a bit like kind of those old Batman movies, kind of the biff, pow kind of approach. Unfortunately, that interpretation, although it's has a dramatic rhetorical value, isn't actually particularly likely. There's another interpretation of it, that it's the direct way, and this has a bit more credence and has become the most popular interpretation in the last couple of decades, since Nyanamoli pointed out that there's a passage in the Majjhima Nikaya where it talks about a man walking along a path, and the context makes it clear that they're walking along a path that leads to one destination. So once you've started on that path, it can only take you to one place. Okay, so it's not a forked road. So then this is a clear enough description, but that becomes like a polemical sort. Even Bhikkhu Bodhi made the mistake in his book on the Majjhima Nikaya of saying, well, perhaps that means that it's the way that doesn't go to psychic powers, because that's like another way, and the practice of Satipatthana is direct in that it doesn't deviate through psychic powers, and possibly because it doesn't deviate through the practice of jhanas as well. Unfortunately, there's a whole sanyutta, a whole 30 or 40 suttas or something like that, where Venerable Anuruddha says, well, how did I get all of these psychic powers? And each psychic power, he says, he got specifically and solely from the practice of Satipatthana. So even a scholar as great as Bhikkhu Bodhi can make such a glaring blunder. And we ask ourselves, why is this? And say, because it's when people are driven by ideologies that they are prepared to make such statements that are in such plain contradiction with the evidence that's presented to us by the texts themselves. So to give Bhikkhu Bodhi credit, I don't want to criticize him because I know he has changed his mind on that, but that was something that he wrote a number of years ago. So what else does it mean? Well, as many of you know, I've spoken about this a number of times in my talks, and I'll keep on repeating it as long as I can find anyone who's willing to sit there and listen to me. And this phrase, ekayana, actually doesn't really belong specifically in the Satipatthana Sutta. That's the first mistake that the commentators have made. It actually mainly belongs in the Samyutta Nikaya. And when we see it in use in the Samyutta Nikaya, it mainly belongs in the mouth of Brahma. It doesn't belong in the mouth of Buddha. It's actually Brahma who says this is the one-way path. The Buddha says it as well, but Brahma says it very prominently, in both in the Pali and Chinese sources. So that makes us wonder, well, maybe we should be looking at the Brahmanical sources. Maybe actually this isn't a Buddhist term. Maybe this is one of those very many words which Buddhism adopted from the Brahmanical culture. And when we look in the Brahmanical scriptures, we see exactly that. We see this very, very powerful passage in a scripture called the Briharanyaka. It's actually the most important of all the Brahmanical scriptures from the meditative and spiritual side. And this is the most important sage, the most important meditator in that most important scripture. And this is the most important dialogue by the most important sage in the most important scripture of the Brahmanical tradition. This is not tucked away in some obscure corner. This is right there in the center, the core, the key of the whole Brahmanical pre-Buddhist philosophy is right there. Yajnavalkya says he wants to go forth. His wife, Maitreyi, says, and he says to Maitreyi, he says, I want to make a settlement with you before I go forth. And I want to divide up my wealth. He had two wives, so I'll divide my wealth between his two wives, Maitreyi and Katyayani. And Katyayani was one who was said to be only skilled in that wisdom of which women are skilled in, whereas Maitreyi was a genuine spiritual seeker. So when her husband said this, she said, if you were to give me all of the wealth in the whole world, would that free me from death? And Yajnavalkya said, no, it wouldn't. So she said, please teach me. I'm not interested in all that wealth. I want you to teach me what you know so I can be led beyond death. So Yajnavalkya said, well, before you've always been dear to me, but now you're especially dear. And then he launches into this dialogue, which I can't repeat all of it here, but starts out, not for the sake of the husband that the husband is dear, it's for the sake of the self that the husband is dear. It's not for the sake of the wife that the husband is dear, it's for the sake of the wife that the wife is dear, it's for the sake of the self that the wife is dear. It's not for the sake of one's parents that one's parents are dear, but for the sake of the self that one's parents are dear. And on and on and on it goes, referring everything back to this one thing, this one self. And he goes on and on and on, talking about what this self is, on and on about this one self. And then he comes to this passage, the second last passage of this whole Upanishad. It's like building up to a crescendo. It's just the penultimate moment in this key dialogue right at the heart of that whole Brahmanical spiritual tradition. Just as the eye is the ekayana, the one way, the convergence place of all sights. Just as the ear is the convergence, the place for coming together, the ekayana of all sounds. Just as the nose is the ekayana, the convergence place of all smells, just as the tongue is the ekayana of all tastes. And on he goes, just as the ocean is the ekayana of all rivers, or always bringing it back to that one. There is this one thing and they all converge on those things. Yeah? And so too, he says, this whole world has been produced from this sheer, what he calls this sheer mass of consciousness, vijnana ganameva. He says this is that self, is just that sheer mass of consciousness, that vijnana ganameva. This whole world having arisen out of this will reabsorb back into this sheer mass of consciousness. And that is the self. And this is the teaching of Yajnavalkya. And it's the core teaching of the whole of the Upanishadic non-dual tradition. And the key term, the most often repeated term, is ekayana, repeated again and again and again and again, over and over. That one place where everything comes to converge, everything comes together. And so when in the Buddhist context, when we hear Brahma, using that word ekayana, surely we're justified in thinking that this is what's being talked about here. This is that path that leads to that convergence. It leads to that coming together. It leads to that unification, where all of that diversity, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, that whole world out there, vanishes, and we return to that one source, that one heart, that sheer mass of consciousness. Of course, the difference between Buddhism and the Upanishadic doctrine, obviously, it shouldn't need stating, is that the Upanishads are always talking about the self, and the Buddhists talked about not self. So obviously, we don't take this sheer mass of consciousness to be a self. And in that respect, it's different from the Upanishadic tradition. But in terms of the actual leading to that convergence, that experience is identical. The phrasing is identical, and I would suggest that the meaning is identical. And that is the purpose of this practice of Satipatthana. The practice of Satipatthana is to lead to that convergence in one place. And this is why the Buddha said that here, the foolish, unskilled monk who doesn't know the teaching, doesn't understand the teaching, and doesn't know what they're doing, practice contemplating a body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having removed covetousness and grief from the world. But because he's foolish and unskilled, his mind does not enter into samadhi, his mind does not become one-pointed. And notice the same usage of that word one, same meaning, his mind does not go into that oneness, does not become unified. And therefore that foolish, unskilled monk does not reap the fruits of that practice. Whereas the diligent, skillful, wise monk practices Satipatthana and his mind enters into samadhi, he gains one-pointedness, he gains that unity, that convergence into one place. So this is, I think, the meaning of that ekayana. It's that convergence, that bringing into oneness. And the whole focus, the whole meaning of Satipatthana practice is to bring your mind into that oneness. Not because, and I repeat again, because this is something that it just becomes like a bludgeon to beat over the head of this kind of practice. People say, oh well, you're just doing Hindu practice. The point is that it's not, the difference is not the difference in the actual state of samadhi or meditation that's reached. The difference is in how we understand that, how we relate to that state of consciousness. That's different. But the state of mind itself is just the same. So what Satipatthana is a series of skillful means for realizing that kind of unification, for realizing that kind of deep stillness and unity. This is why the Buddha said that it is the four Satipatthanas that are the cause for right samadhi. Right samadhi meaning, of course, the four jhanas. So these four Satipatthanas are the cause for the four jhanas. When you have the four Satipatthanas, the four jhanas come into being. And the Satipatthana puts that practice into a context of understanding, so that as we're doing it, we're doing it with right view. We understand the process of meditation. So we meditate to attain the unification, that's one side. Just to forget that deep stillness and clarity of mind is one side. The other side is to understand that. What does it mean? What does it feel like? Why does it feel like that? That's the other side of Satipatthana. So these two aspects of it always go hand in hand, and these two aspects, of course, being samatha and vipassana. So Satipatthana has both of these aspects, samatha and vipassana, in there. But the main focus is the samatha. The main focus is to actually make the mind unified and peaceful. And that's why this is the way to Nibbana. And this is what the Buddha said in that phrase, the opening phrase of Satipatthana. It's a way to get enlightened. So when we're practicing Satipatthana, obviously there's a, in a sense, a kind of a progressive aspect to the practice. That is that, you know, we start out with things that are more simple, more coarse, more obvious. We get our mind very clearly built on that, established on that, grounded on that, and then our mind becomes more and more subtle, more and more refined, and leading up to deeper and deeper levels of contemplation. One of the interesting things about that process is that we need most help on those initial stages. That's because our minds are the most confused, and because we've got the least understanding and clarity about what we're doing. So when we start off, we need a lot of help. Yeah. Once we're well established, then we need less help, we need less guidance, and so things get easier and simpler as they go along. And that's exactly like it is with learning any other kind of skill. If you've ever learnt to play a sport, you'll know that when you're first starting off, you know, you need a coach to be there to show you all every detail. If you're playing tennis, how do you hold the racket? What do you do? What are the rules? Where do you put your feet? Every detail they have to show you. After a while, they need to just look in on you from time to time and check that you're doing okay, and maybe correct you occasionally, but they can trust that you know what you're doing. Same thing with meditation. You start out, you need a lot of guidance on those early stages. The later stages, you can be mostly trusted as long as you know the general direction that you're going in. So the basic formula of Satipatthana, kaya kaya nupassi viharati. We were talking a little bit about this morning, contemplate the body in the body. And what does it mean? Again, has many, many kinds of meanings, or can have many implications. I mean, it's quite a vague term. It's more of an evocative term rather than a definitive one. Kaya kaya anupassi viharati. Kaya kaya anupassi viharati. When we hear it in Pali, we can hear the kind of the repetitiveness of it, the sonorous quality that it has. Kaya kaya anupassi viharati. Vedana su vedana nupassi. It's got this kind of rhythm when we chant it. Citta citta nupassi, citta citta nupassi, dhamme su dhamma nupassi. You have this kind of rolling rhythm that kind of emphasizes the quality of it. So that's part of the meaning. And I think, as we discussed this morning, part of the meaning also is that it has a sense of like focusing or narrowing your viewpoint. When we look at all the exercises describing these practices, they're always about specifying like certain kinds of the body, certain aspects of the body that you look at, certain aspects of feelings that you're supposed to focus on. So it's like, yeah, you look at the feelings and then you focus on these particular aspects of them. And that's what I think this repetitive idiom is saying. Kaya kaya anupassi. Anupassi, what does that mean? Anupassana, to anu, along, passana, to see. Observe along with something, like to anu, when it's used in a psychological sense, means to sustain. Very often means to sustain, to keep on. So anupassana is to keep on contemplating, keep on observing. It's different from vipassana. We're very familiar with that word, vipassana. Vi has the idea of to split apart. So vi has an analytical implication, to analyze something, to see through something. Whereas anu doesn't have that implication. Anu means to go along with something, to watch along with it, to flow along with that. Yeah? So to contemplate along with something. This is what anupassana means. And then it's followed by this phrase, which is a very standard phrase. Atapi means one has energy, so four right efforts. Sampajana is the wisdom aspect. Is always there, in the sense of clear comprehension. We'll talk about more about that later. Satima is mindfulness itself. And vinaya loke abhijja domanasam. Again, this is a very controversial phrase, which several theses have been written about. Vinaya means having got rid of. Loke, for the world. Abhijja means greed. Domanasa normally means grief, but in this context it means ill will. So what this phrase probably refers to it's a bit controversial because it's like in a past tense. It refers to something which has already been completed, having removed covetousness and displeasure for the world. And in this context, what it probably means is that one has gained a certain degree of equanimity regarding worldly dhammas through the previous development of the more preliminary stages of the path. That means through establishing oneself in sila, through practicing sense restraint, mindfulness in daily life, contentment, all of those kinds of things that are leading up to meditation, the basis, the platform for meditation, especially the practice of sense restraint. And so when one has all these things, these have tended to reduce, and that the more complicated we get, the more we lose touch with these simple things. There have been many people that talk about this and talk about, if you're familiar with a lot of the writings of, say, transpersonal psychologists like Ken Wilber and many of the others have developed these very sophisticated ideas about psychology and so on, and one of the main themes of so many of them is just how out of touch with the body that we are, especially in Western society. We become so head-obsessed, so up there in the clouds, that we just lose touch. And you know, people write very, very massive, complicated philosophical treatises about it, which explain the problem in great detail. I don't know if they actually help it very much, but they certainly explain it. And, you know, as usual, Ajahn Chah kind of pointed to the same thing, just so much more brilliantly. He just pointed to the sky and said, "You Westerners, you know all about that, but you don't know anything about that." Yeah, it says it all. Well, learn about that, okay? Learn about that. When you walk up and down the path, what is that dirt like that you're standing on? What is the pressure on the soles of your feet like? What are these very, very simple, basic things? What are they like? What is it like to walk? What is it like to walk? What does it feel like? What is the actual experience like to actually just walk, to not do anything else, not to walk and think, not to walk and drink a cup of coffee, not to walk and chat with somebody, not to walk and look at the flowers, not to walk and listen to the birds, but just to walk? What's that like? That one thing. Ekayana. What happens if your whole world of experience is just that walking? What is that like? Just that much dukkha. You know what the dukkha of walking is about. And even though this walking is not like a very kind of deep samadhi practice, but it is still possible to make your mind very, very joyous and very peaceful about it. I remember Ajahn used to tell the story that he stayed in this monastery with a monk called Thanh At, and Thanh At was very diligent, and they used to finish their meal at 9 o'clock, and he used to get on his walking path and walk until 3 o'clock in the afternoon every day when they had their chores. And Ajahn tried to keep up for a couple of days and then gave up. And he said to him, "How do you do it? You know, how do you manage to keep going every day, not just once or twice, but every day? You know, you must be really kind of, you know, pushing yourself. You know, you must have a really strong determination to keep walking for 6 hours every day after the meal through the heat of the day." He said, "Oh, no, it's not like that. You just get on the walking path and start walking, and I just sort of bliss out, and then it's 3 o'clock and it's time for the chores." And if your mind's peaceful, it's like that. If it's not like that, then why isn't it like that? If you're not just sitting, walking up and down, just floating. It's what my teacher, Ajahn Chachai, says. He, when he goes out on arms round, he just kind of floats around and then floats back again. And goes for a long walk, but he just kind of floats around the streets of Bangkok. Looks like he's kind of walking, but from him inside, he's just kind of floating around and just sort of comes back. And when your mind is peaceful, it's like that. It's just so light. You realize how much of our effort is just that bodily tension that's caused by our mind fighting itself. Our mind fighting itself. The conflicts, the strains, the stresses in our mind is causing our muscles to be tense, causing our energies to be stirred up, causing blood to flow not improperly, all of these kinds of things. And so we're using just so much more effort. You know, like you experience in breath meditation, if you sit down and watch your breath for a while, it becomes peaceful. And, you know, and you realize how much lighter your body feels and all of those tensions go. Well, you can experience the same thing when you're doing walking meditation. So you have this feeling of complete balance and like flow, so the energy is flowing, and you realize there's just so much lightness there. You realize actually it's not so hard to just lift one foot up and put it down, and to just keep on doing it like that, like that, like that, like that. You learn what it's like when you're just moving your body, feeling those muscles, feeling the way the muscles working on the bones, and you realize that there's that after just practicing, going back and practicing that thing we call walking, you realize after a while there's a flow there, there's a beauty to it, there's an elegance to it, there's like a this skill in walking mindfully. And so you kind of like float up and down, you end up floating up and down the walking path. Sometimes that happens a little bit more literally than other times. There was one story about Ajahn Chah when he was walking meditation, and he was walking up and down, and he started to sink into the walking path until he was up to his chest in the walking path. He was all walking up and down, and then he started rising up again and started rising, but he didn't stop when he got to the path. He kept on going. He was walking up and down the path and floated up to the trees, and he got to the top of the trees, and then he exploded. And then all his organs went down, and he could just see all his liver and his lungs and all these bits of his body just lying splattered all over the trees all around him. He wondered, what's going on here? So you can see this is like he went to ask his teacher, I think it was Ajahn Rinpoche Ginnery. And Ginnery is a very strange name for a monk. Ginnery literally means, what kind of woman is that? I can't explain it, alright? This is what it means. And so Lumpur Ginnery said, what's he doing? He said, because Ajahn Chah, of course, was a bit disturbed by this experience. And Lumpur Ginnery said, you've reached the end of perception. Yeah? So when you're practicing this walking meditation, you're coming up and down the path, walking, walking, walking. As you do so, your perception is changing. That perception of diversity, all of the sight, sound, smell, taste, all of that is starting to go away, and you're focusing on your body. And that perception of the body, the movement of the feet. And then that your perception of time starts to change, like that story of Tan An. His perception of time was changing. It wasn't that he was forcing himself to say, I'm going to walk for 6 hours, here I go, slogging up and down. But it's just his perception of time. He went into like a timeless space, so the mind is peaceful. And then time smooths out. Actually, time is only, you know, we only have the perception of time because we have a perception of diversity. There's ups and downs, there's jagged, you know, like crests and troughs. And when there's crests and troughs, then we can measure time. But when there aren't crests and troughs, then there's just a smooth line. You haven't got anything to measure time against. So when the mind is peaceful, and time just becomes this very, very gentle wave, and we just drift along that very gentle wave rather than being this very kind of short, jagged thing that we normally perceive time as. And so, doing a walking meditation, we keep on bringing our mind back. Back and back and back. Thoughts, just let them go. You'll tend to think more when you're walking meditation. It's okay, don't worry about it. Just keep on, just make your determination very clear. It's useful to stop. When you reach the end of the path, stop and clear your mind of thoughts. You turn around, you determine. When you're going to start walking again, you determine, I'm going to walk to the end and not think. I'm just going to watch, pay attention to the sensations in my body. And then you walk and you get to the end, and again you stop, clear your mind, start again, walk back. That's why we walk in a straight line up and down, because you stop. You have a repeated time to stop. And if you don't stop, then you're just going to keep on going round and round and round and round and round and round in circles. So that's why we don't build walking paths in circles, just in case you're wondering. Yeah. And if you ever tried it, it's really true. If you've ever tried walking meditation in circles, sounds like a good idea, but that's exactly what happens. Your mind starts going round and round and round and round and round and round, and round in endless circles. So a line is something that has a beginning and an end. So we walk and we stop. We give ourselves a chance to check ourselves. We walk again, we stop. Walk again, we stop. So when you're doing walking meditation, as I've been explaining, like the basic practice is very, very simply just be aware of your posture. And really, I can't recommend anything more highly than that. I can't sort of, I mean, I can give lots of fancy meditation techniques for doing walking meditation, but really there's nothing better than simply just knowing where you're at when you're doing it. If you do want to do other practices when you're walking, then, you know, that's fine as well. Walking is a very good posture for learning chanting. Many of you becoming interested in learning some Pali and some chanting, well, do it on your walking path. It's the best place to do it. You'll remember it much better than if you're just trying to sit and memorize something. That's how I memorized all of my chanting, was either walking meditation or when going on alms round and so on. I'm not sure why it is. There's just something about that walking posture that makes it kind of flow very nicely. So you can do that. You can use the walking posture for doing other kinds of meditation as well. So sometimes it's good to do something else because just watching the walking itself is not interesting enough. So you can do, for example, watching your breath and breathe in with your right foot forward, breathe out with your left foot. Breathe in with your right foot, breathe out with your left foot. Breathe in with the right foot, breathe out with the left foot, and so on. If you do that, then that will keep you walking quite slow, and because it's quite a bit difficult to coordinate your breath and your feet like that, then it'll give your mind something a bit to work with. It'll give you a kind of a challenge, and that can give your mind more interest, so you actually stay with that. Or else you can do metta meditation while you're walking, just saying metta, metta, in time with your feet, metta, and bringing up that feeling of metta as you're walking inside your feet, inside your legs. Or you can do basically any other kind of meditation. You can be adapted for walking as well. And you keep continuing the same job that you're doing in sitting meditation, you're continuing in walking. And so this is something that's very highly praised by the Buddha and very highly praised, spoken of often in the suttas. And people would go and visit monasteries and they'd see the monks walking meditation under the trees. And of course is one of the main practices of the forest tradition. And even one of the great forest masters, I can't remember which one it was now, but he used to have three walking paths near his kuti. And in the morning he'd walk on one for 3 hours and say Buddha, Buddha, Buddha for 3 hours. And then you go to the second one and walk on there for 3 hours and go Dhammo, Dhammo, Dhammo. And then go to the third one and go Sangho, Sangho, Sangho. And then use that recollection for 3 hours on each path. And then at the end in the evening, later in the evening when he was finished with his walking, he would go and sit meditation for about an hour or so in the night time. So that was his way of practice. So there are many of the forest masters would do a lot of this walking meditation. Another one is Lumpu Dun. He used to do a lot of walking to the extent that he used to sleep on his walking path. Just use his arm for his pillow, walk until he got too tired to sleep, to walk anymore, and then lie down for a rest. And then when he's rested, then get up and keep walking again. So that's another good thing you can try. That's a little bit cold to do that in Vandenoon. I used to do that in Perth sometimes when it was a bit warmer, but I haven't done it in Vandenoon. Ajahn Chah used to love the walking posture, and he used to walk even in the rain. And when it was raining, he wouldn't walk meditation. He thought, oh, you can't walk in the rain. And he thought, well, why not? He thought, well, the villagers are out there working on the farm. If they can go out there and collect rice in the rain, why can't I do walking meditation in the rain? Which is more valuable, collecting rice or getting the deathless? Well, getting the deathless is more valuable, so I'll get out there and walk. So he'd walk up and down in the rain. Everyone would say, Ajahn Chah's going crazy. He's out there walking in the rain. So again, it's a little bit cold to do that in Vandenoon, not recommended here. But just to show you how valuable that the teachers in the forest tradition regarded this practice, not something to be just sort of sidelined or dismissed lightly, but something that's very important. And if you are spending a long time in retreat, a lot of time doing meditation, it's your main practice during the day, if you're spending many hours every day doing meditation, then you know you need to do some variations in your posture. You need to get some exercise, get some fresh air, stretch yourself out, and get your body working a bit. And it stops your mind from being too lazy. Sometimes when we do a lot of sitting meditation, it just becomes like lazy. We just can't be bothered doing anything with our mind. And so just to overcome that, and that's really one of the greatest benefits of walking, is just simply to give ourselves energy. And it really energizes your mind. So try to walk for a good long walk, especially after the meal is a great time to do walking meditation. And then you go and sit meditation, and you usually find your mind's a lot brighter and a lot more stable if you sit after you've been doing some walking. So that's my little talk this evening on walking meditation. So to be highly encouraged, so this is the first talk in a series of talks on the Bodhipakya Dhammas and on Satipatthana in particular. So I offer that to you for your reflection and for your practice. And if anyone has any comments or questions.
Is there a recommended length for walking paths, or does it sort of come down the person and see what works best for you?
Yeah, there is. I mean, the standard length is usually 20 paces. But also it partly is a character thing. According to the Visuddhimagga, if you've got a speculative temperament, yeah, that means if you think a lot, then you should have a short walking path. Okay, so that means you can stop at the end very often and stop your change of thought. On the other hand, if you're what kinds of character want a long walking path? I think if you're, can't remember now, I think if you're a dosa charita, if you're an angry type, then you want to have a long walking path so you can kind of stretch out, build up a bit of pace, yeah? Work it off a bit. So it also depends on the style of walking you want to do and also the reason you're doing it. In the forest tradition, style of walking is a bit speedier than most. Sometimes it's very fast, actually. Boom, 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 boom. And it partly depends on the reason. Sometimes you just really feel lethargic in that and you want to get some energy, you know. And if that's your aim, then get on your path and sort of stretch out and get a long path and walk up and down relatively quickly to build up your energy. But if you want to be very much more kind of close mindfulness, then of course you want to walk more slowly. So generally the best pace is like a little bit slower than a normal walking pace. So in the forest, you know, obviously in Mahasi tradition and so on, they do like a very, very slow walking meditation. And that's also good training. But I think it's maybe a little bit too artificial. Ajahn Chah would always emphasize just be natural in what you're doing. And so just a walking meditation, be quite just dignified. You know, I really can't imagine that the Buddha and the Arahants were like going raising, forwarding, downing, stepping, raising. I just don't think that they actually used to do that. I think they just used to kind of walk, but just be mindful about it. And so 20 paces is good. Longer, up to 30 paces, 30-something paces is good. Usually forest tradition, they prefer longer rather than shorter. It's too much shorter than 20 paces is getting a bit cramped. Maybe 15 is okay. 12 is probably getting a little bit cramped. Yeah. I always remember the one that I had. They built a really good one for me when I was staying in Nan. A really good walking path. And when they finished it, I paced it to see how long it was. And then the workers asked me, they said, how long is it? And I said, oh, Samsip Gal, 39 paces. And they said, oh, okay. And they went away. And then a few weeks later, the workman met the guy who owned the kuti, and he said, you know that Western monk? He said, oh, he gives great lottery numbers. He said, what are you talking about? He said, oh, when I was there, I asked him about his walking path, and he told me he was 39. And I thought, oh, yeah, it's a lottery. So I went out and I told all my mates, I said, you know, 39, we've got to buy a 39 lottery number. And all his friends said, nah, don't be silly, it's a load of rubbish. He said, no, really. So they went out and he bought number 39 lottery ticket, and he won. Ah, it's really good, the best lottery numbers. So I thought, oh, there you go. And then it was quite funny, they told me that story, and then the next day, I was staying in this village, I went for alms round, and the people in that village didn't know, I didn't think they knew, the people who owned the kuti at all, they're from a different place. And I went for alms round, and there was this one fellow who had been giving alms every day for months, and never spoken to him, he'd just come out and give me a bit of rice and go back and never spoken. And then this one day, straight after I'd heard this, he said to me, oh, by the way, Excuse me, Venerable, how old are you? I said, oh, 36, and then walked on. What are you asking for? The classic one in Thailand. Well, obviously my reputation had started to spread.
And I remember in the upper monastery I had the, I was in, they had planks around the monastery, or wooden planks.
Mm-hmm.
And the abbot there, when he originally built the monastery, said that he built it so that he knew if people were mindful or not, and they were walking around the monastery. Because if you weren't mindful, you would hear this boom, boom, boom around the monastery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he said that he built it originally to train the lay people to be mindful. He said that it came in handy for a good training tool for the monks and nuns.
Mm.
He said it took 2 years to train one of the nuns to be mindful and walking around the monastery.
Mm.
It was quite a good experience walking around the monastery because you had to be mindful. You could tell if you weren't mindful because
going clomp, clomp, clomp.
Clomp, clomp, clomp.
Yeah. Yeah.